This is a Dauntless Media Collective podcast. Visit dauntless.fm for more content.
Hey everyone, I'm Nate from the Full Mutuality podcast. I wanted to take a moment to say thank you for tuning into this show. We're so grateful that you've decided to spend your time with us. Seriously, Dan, Gail, Jessica, Kathleen, Scott, and the rest of us here at the Dauntless Media Collective couldn't produce content like the show you're listening to without your support. I'd also like to invite you even further into the conversation. Right now, there are some great discussions happening over in the Dauntless Media Collective Discord server. If you're interested in chatting with other folks who are deconstructing and decolonizing the oppressive traditions that they came from, please feel free to hop on into the server. If you don't know what Discord is, it's a place where communities can gather online for chatting on a wide variety of topics. In our Discord server, we have channels devoted to general deconstruction conversations, some meme sharing, therapeutic venting about whatever religious bullshit you're currently dealing with, and even a channel specifically devoted to talking about the latest episodes of the podcast you're listening to right now. I hope you'll join us. You can log in directly to the Dauntless server by clicking the link in the show notes or heading to dauntless.fm and clicking the link in the top banner. See you there.
All right.
Okay. Welcome to the Thereafter podcast, a place where we explore life on the other side of faith change.
We're here to break down the binaries, deconstruct the dualities, and wander through what it looks like to live in the gray.
In church, we were told that life after leaving would be a bitter wasteland of unfulfilling hedonism, but we've discovered quite the opposite.
There's actually a vibrant community of people on the other side of faith who are finding and co-creating space for hope and healing.
Come along as we explore the all too often uncharted expanse of evangelicalism, evolving faith, and the life thereafter. All right, we're back. Another episode of the Thereafter podcast. We have Portland.
What up?
And we have a guest. We have a returning guest. We have Alicia. Say hi.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
It was kind of a, I'm not going to say emergency, but we had a topic we wanted to chat about, and we wanted to have the conversation on the air because it was something I was wrestling with publicly on Twitter, and a lot of people had opinions, and you weighed in, and I loved what you said, and we've all been kind of talking about this outside of social media, and so I just thought it would be kind of fun to hit record and kind of wrestle through together some of the stuff. So I guess we'll just get started and maybe give the context for our listeners.
Yeah, sounds great.
Yeah, awesome. So really the concept is like there's this book coming out, The Widening of God's Mercy by Christopher Hayes and Richard Hayes, who I am not familiar with their work. I will say that right off the bat. But what happened was I started to see on Twitter and Instagram all of these people that were like, this is such a huge deal. Finally, this is such a big deal. Let's celebrate. And it was about these men becoming affirming. And I had a lot of thoughts and opinions about how much that was celebrated, juxtaposed with how harmful the theology that they previously held has been. And so I'll open that to get started, and we can just wander in any direction that we want to. But just initially, I guess I would ask you, Alicia, like what was your reaction? Did you come across this separately than my thread, or what was your reaction kind of initially just seeing all of this dialogue about it?
Yeah. I first saw on Twitter with, who's that pastor in Texas?
Zach.
Is his last name. Yeah, Zach. That was the first time I saw it. And honestly, I didn't care, to be completely honest. but there's reasons why it's seen as a big deal. So like, just some background on the authors, like Richard Hayes wrote, I think it was Christianity Today that gave his like New Testament ethics book as one of the top 100 books for Christians to read. And it kind of became this standard ethics book for like Bible colleges and stuff. Like not the Bible college that I went to, because even he would have been too liberal for my school, but that's besides the point. Anyways, like he's known for being a New Testament scholar who does focus on ethics. And in the book that he wrote that came out in the mid 90s, he was very, very much against anything LGBTQ plus. Honestly, I don't think he talked about trans people. He really just talked about homosexuality. That's, you know, that's just kind of where it was at the time. So for him to come out and write a book that is like opposite of what he said, what, 30 years ago, is in that circle kind of a big deal, because it shows like, hey, people can actually change and stuff. And that's positive. On the flip side, like, this work's already been done by a lot of other people. And like, it, the only reason why this is seen as a huge step is because, hooray, we finally got the cishet white guy to say something. Like, that's really all it is that he's the white guy that's finally, you know, coming forth and saying that he's affirming. I think it would have been cooler if Eugene Peterson had done that, because he actually did become affirming before he died, but he was kind of too old to like write about it. But in that sense, like, it's a big deal because of that. But like, at the same time, it's like, oh my goodness, why are we still caring what cishet white guys have to say? Like, they've had the majority of theological voice over the past, I don't know, whenever Christianity became predominantly European. So like 1300 years, I guess. Like, it's been almost entirely white since then. Like, there's other voices. Let's recognize the fact that these guys are not the first ones doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that there's a couple points that you mentioned there, Alicia, like, that are, I think, reasons why people have reacted the way they have. One being that this was specifically something that Richard Hayes had addressed in the condemning sense explicitly. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, you have situations where you have guys like Andy Stanley or other people who have been real ambiguous and kind of, mm-hmm. you know, we talk about people like Shane Claiborne, and, you know, like, they're like, ooh, they're, you know, kind of wobble around the issue and don't really say anything too specific in order to like stay out of, the topic. He had specifically addressed, like, yes, this is wrong. Yes, I condemn this. And so I think the undoing of that is something that people found important to, like, say, mm-hmm. I was wrong. I specifically said this, and I specifically am saying the opposite now. So I think that that's one aspect where people maybe a little bit more than, you know, some other white dude theologians who may become affirming, made a big deal of this announcement. And then secondarily, I think that there is an aspect of like what happened with Eugene Peterson, where Eugene Peterson essentially did say that he was affirming in that mm-hmm. interview with Jonathan Merritt.
Merritt,
there we go. Yeah. And then basically, I think his family was like, oh no, he didn't know what he was saying, and wrote a statement for him and essentially undid it, because Lifeway Christian Stores threatened to basically pull all of his works out of every store and financially ruin their family forever or whatever, right?
Yeah, that's basically it.
And I think that there's an aspect of people wanting to, I guess, you know, see a different thing happen than what happened with Eugene Peterson, right? Where the backlash causes mm-hmm. a recoil. You think about what happened with World Vision in like 2000, was it like 2010, 2000, 12, something right around even, there.
Yeah, somewhere around there. I remember Rachel Held Evans talking about that. Yes.
Yeah, World Vision said, hey, we're going to like explicitly allow for queer people to work at our organization, and we're going to honor those people and their identities in our organization. And it was like hours before the conservative internet and their conservative base freaked out to such an extent that they recanted that and said, no, actually, you know, we're going to explicitly double down. So I think that there is, to some extent, an aspect of people wanting to do the opposite, right? Celebrate something so dramatically to offset any possible pushback that might come to, again, encourage more people to follow in this behavior. And it's really about, for some people, like encouraging the behavior in the right direction. But I do think that there is this unintended consequence of centering the wrong person and the wrong thing in these narratives, which is what Megan's thread and your statements online through, you know, your posts have brought out.
Okay, well, and I want to say that when I see this, I know that I tend to sometimes be extreme, right? And I also need to take a beat and recognize that I had growth that had to happen in my life to get to the point where I'm at today. And I had people that, you know, had grace for me. I wasn't a published author. I didn't have a public, you know, platform when I was going through that process. And so it looked different for me. But when I see the very first reaction as, oh, look at, like, we should celebrate this, this is incredible, it reminded me, and I said this in the thread, it reminded me of like when Rick Warren's church decided to start ordaining women, and they had women that had worked in that church for decades, and they were like, isn't it so great, instead of volunteering, now that they can be on our staff? And I'm like, you're not even taking a moment to recognize that these women were not seen or heard for decades. And so it's like now the same, I'm seeing this thing with queer affirmation, and I feel like we're on the brink of more and more pastors becoming queer affirming and everyone just kind of forgetting about the trauma and pain that they've caused all this along this way. And so I think that's where I'm kind of wrestling and sitting in. And I'm curious what both of your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly like important aspect to talk about, especially in these spaces, because most of these pastors don't necessarily recognize the harm that they've done. And honestly, like, this is kind of goes back to whenever the Reformation Project tried to make a distinction between affirming and queer theology.
Yes.
Essentially, like, forcing affirmation to fit into evangelical theology is essentially what this is. And the truth is, the evangelical church is declining. One of the major reasons is treatment of LGBTQ plus people, as both in the church and within the politics. Like, it's actually bad for business right now. Fuller Theological Seminary is like mentioned as one of the schools that actively discriminates against LGBTQ plus students. Students from Fuller are on the Hunter v. Department of Education lawsuit that is backed by REAP. Fuller is not affirming, but they're also dealing with the fact that there are queer people like showing up at their school. And so they're kind of at a risk of like losing some of their students just because some of their students are becoming affirming. They have students at their school becoming affirming. Like, it is, being unaffirming of queer people is going to hurt the financial bottom line at some point. And the fact is we are seeing people like expand their theology to include queer people, but at the same time maintain the same theology that got there. It's exactly what we see like with theology in the Southern Baptist Church. Like, the truth is, the Southern Baptist Church started because Baptists didn't like that Northern Baptists were becoming like abolitionists. Like, the Baptist Church said, hey, you can't become a missionary and own slaves because that might influence the way that you act on the mission field. Southern Baptists were like, nope, we're going to start our own denomination. And that's what they did. In Augusta, Georgia, they started the Southern Baptist Church and was the first denomination to back the Confederate Army, specifically on the topic of slavery. That dehumanization has always carried through SBC theology. And even if the Southern Baptist Convention becomes queer affirming, if they're never going to address the actual foundation of their theology, it's going to continue harm. And so that's kind of where we don't celebrate. I said this on Twitter, we celebrate the progress of the oppressor. We don't celebrate the oppressor. And this is really what this is. This is progress because it becomes affirming. Because like I said, there are going to be parents who read this book and will accept their queer kid and not disown them because this book exists. There are going to be net positives. So we celebrate that. We celebrate that progress. We don't celebrate the oppressor who's still upholding oppressive systems because it's going to continue to produce harm. And the title of their book is The Widening of Mercy, which we have a terrible understanding of mercy within within the evangelical church, but in most Western Christianity, even Catholicism, and often I include Greek Orthodox as Western because they're technically Roman, because the Roman emperor split Rome into two and Constantinople became the new capital of Rome, and that's where Greek Orthodox comes from. Anyways, I consider them Western just because they still have very Western roots. Mercy is completely misunderstood in what it meant in the first century, where the understanding is far more compassion, not necessarily you deserve this, but I'm going to withhold it from you because I am great. It's I understand that you are going through something. I'm going to help you out. There's a difference between that, withholding punishment versus actually caring for somebody. That theologically speaking, because I know their background, this idea of mercy comes from the idea of total depravity. It comes from the idea of penal substitutionary atonement, where the wages of sin means literal damnation for everyone, where God had to pour out wrath on somebody. But because of mercy, God poured out his anger on Jesus. The foundational roots of even their affirmation is in fact harming. And we can see it right there in the title. So the fact is this is great. What is going to come is a step in the right direction, but we don't necessarily need to celebrate the people upholding terrible systems. It's Georgia wrapped up their legislative cycle and they had 6 anti-LGBTQ+ bills that were able to be passed, and the legislative cycle ended and none of them passed. 2 of them got incredibly close, if they had a half day longer, they would have got passed, but they didn't. And so that's progress. Georgia has another year of not having anti-LGBTQ+ laws. That's a net positive. We don't go around celebrating the Republicans that didn't pass it before the legislative cycle ended. No, we celebrate the fact that more harm didn't come, and we celebrate the fact that we have more time, but we don't celebrate the oppressor because they did the bare minimum, or I don't know. I mean, in the case of the legislature, they just really didn't care enough to pass it. But I mean, to me, it's very much the same thing. Yes, this is a positive and we celebrate the positive, but we don't have to celebrate the person that's still causing harm.
Yeah. And I think for me, there's this aspect of we need both, right? We need to have people who are you know, to some extent, like saying this is a good thing, right? Like that affirmation mm-hmm. of progress in the right direction is helpful. And to some extent, like not having people like myself get real excited about it is in and of itself somewhat helpful, right? Like somebody like my mom is going to be more swayed by seeing a couple more middle of the road, moderate white men get excited about this, and is probably going to even be more compelled by that moderate white man's approval of this progress when I go, fuck that, right? Or like when I kind of oppose it a little bit, right? So there's almost a balance. There's almost a thing of working together of where like if I'm continuing to push a little bit further past and I'm kind of seen as the extremist by the middle, mm-hmm. as the middle begins to push the pendulum a little bit and then I push against the middle, we're dragging everyone slowly towards progress. But I think that what Megan brings up in her critique is important because I personally experienced this and saw this with race in the sense that like my grandparents were overtly racist. My grandfather said the N-word to me. My grandmother told me overtly black and white people should not get married, right? So it was overt racism. My parents were not overtly racist. They were subtly racist, right? And so there is a danger in not observing that there is a continuation of the problem in that subtlety, to think that we solved it because, well, my grandfather used the N-word and my parents didn't, so therefore racism is, air quote, solved, right? That, I think, is what Megan tends to be calling out in these threads, and lots of people have said, hey, by saying like this is like we have somehow solved, you know, the problem by, you know, these establishment folks becoming affirming, we're going to miss that there's a lot more work to do. There's a lot more things to be solved. There's a lot more foundational, like Alicia, like you're saying, foundational mm-hmm. problems that need to get addressed. And if we don't acknowledge that this very small fundamental element is not the entire thing, we could perpetuate harm in subtle ways for a lot longer.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I have some things I need to say.
Go for it.
Absolutely.
This is so helpful. But I also feel like as we've been talking, one of the things that I'm thinking about is I think one of my biggest issues with the celebration of this book is it feels like, and Alicia, you addressed this a little bit when you first started, but it feels a little bit like people are like, finally, a person that we actually listen to is affirming. And it's like, okay, well, you needed a white, cis, straight theologian, like an academic, to say this for you to actually see and hear and value queer people, because we have been screaming, we exist, we're here, we don't feel seen. We have seen queer people traumatized. We've seen queer people lose their lives. And so we're like, here we're screaming, and they're like, oh, we don't really believe you. We don't really understand. We don't really see you. But then like, oh, this guy says it. And so now, or these guys say it. So now we can actually maybe think about it for a minute. And so I think that's one of the things that's the most infuriating about the celebration, especially because like one of the posts that I saw, I pushed back on and in Instagram comments and was told, your reaction should be to accept them as allies. And I'm like, maybe...
Oh, no.
A straight man should not be telling me what my reaction should be. So there's my rant.
Let's be clear here. This is not allyship. Like writing a book saying that LGBTQ plus people can show up to your church, that's not allyship. Like allyship, like you're not an ally until you're showing up to our parades. You're showing up to our Capitol buildings to say, yeah, we deserve equal rights. Like, writing this book, like this, writing a book is just a very long social media post. That's all it is. It
and
makes you feel good.
And how many queer people are they listening to while they're writing this book? That's my other question. Like,
I don't know. Probably Matthew Vines. Let's.
Hopefully not.
I mean,
I think there's a major difference here, Alicia, in what you're saying is like toleration is not celebration, right? Like, like you tolerate us now. That's great. But like, that's not real affirmation is in the celebration, is in the actual act of saying like queerness is beautiful, which is a step way farther than this is going to go, I'm
definitely.
Sure.
But I do want to pick up on what Megan has said here, because this is super important, because what I think, and you can push back on me, because it's me like watching you and then like diagnosing you, and I'm not a therapist or anything like that, but
diagnose away.
Yeah. But what I see happening with Megan, and honestly, it's happening within the side of me, and it happens all the fucking time, like all the time, is it is exposing the fundamental prejudice that we don't necessarily see all the time until it shows up in a place like this. There is a fundamental prejudice against queer theologians, queer Christian authors. And that's not even leaving the Christian like genre. Like there's so many more like queer like spiritual leaders out there that are outside of Christianity. What we're dealing with is a fundamental prejudice against queer people, where the majority of society needs that white guy, the person with privilege in the dominant culture, to say, hey, maybe we were wrong, whenever we've been screaming the whole time. So what we're experiencing is just like that smack in the face of the fact that prejudice still exists against queer people and like how deep it goes. Because all this stuff is said before. There's not going to be a single idea in this book that has not been already written about, talked about, expanded on by queer theologians. But because they're doing it, they'll be listened to, because prejudice still exists fundamentally in our society.
And I think one point of his distinction that's important here is that, like, when Megan and you, Alicia, are saying, like, and maybe this is not what you're saying, so please correct me if I'm putting words in your mouth, but, like I think Megan is definitely saying this, is, like, I'm not going to fucking celebrate. Like, that doesn't mean you shouldn't do this, right? Like, the idea,
Of course.
I think what people hear Megan saying is, like, don't write this book. Shut up, white guys. Right? And that's not what we're saying. Like you should be doing it. You should be doing more. Like, we want you to do it. Just because we are not going to throw you a parade doesn't mean we don't value what you're doing, but it's less than the bare minimum.
Okay, well, I will say this, and you're right. That's absolutely what I'm doing. And there's people that will say, if you constantly say it's not enough to everyone, then when will it ever be? You know, like, what? How is anybody going to come into this space and be able to do anything at all? Here's what I'm going to say. Number one, I'm really fucking jaded, because I have had a lot of cis, straight, white, quote unquote, affirming allies that I've interacted with personally, whether it's been in conversations that we've had in person, whether it's been in DMs, where they have completely talked over me, not listened at all, and just completely bypassed anything that I was saying. So I think, A, I'm jaded, right? I was numbering. Number one, I'm jaded. And number two, I'm going to be honest. I feel that way about racism. I feel like no matter what I do as a, you know, and I can say quote unquote ally, and I say that because I know I can't deem myself that, but no matter what I do, it's never going to be enough. And what I've learned is to be okay with that, to know that no matter what I do when it comes to dismantling white supremacy and when it comes to, you know, really elevating BIPOC voices, Black voices, my, you know, all of these, like all of the things that are happening that are impacting my friends that are different races, different ethnicities, I know it will never be enough. And I'm okay hearing that. And I'm okay knowing that. And I'm okay continuing to do what I can to reduce harm, knowing that no matter what I do, it probably won't be enough. And I think that that's the thing, like these guys want to feel like they've arrived, and they want to feel like they, okay, I, like now, like I get my pat on the back, right? And I think, you know, in the same vein, I would never go to Black friends of mine and say, hey, like I've arrived, right? Like I get a pat on the back if I do this, if I tweeted this, if I said this, if I wrote a thread. Like that's just, and I think when it comes to allyship, or when it comes to how we view people making progress or changing their mind, I think they need to accept that we're going to view it as like, okay, great, you've done the bare minimum. Now prove it to us. Now what? Like, what are you going to do next? Mm-hmm. Like, what? Like, how are you going to advocate for queer people? How are you going to do the actual work? I think that's okay to ask of people what, in whatever type of marginalization and oppression you're fighting.
And I think that there's this, so I have like kind of two different thoughts with stuff that you said. Like, one, but Megan, you and I are runners, right? Like, you've done mostly half marathons. I've done a couple marathons now.
You've arrived.
Nobody's like, what? But when, you know, when you're mile 10 into a marathon, right? Like, you don't need somebody jumping in your way to say, hey, this person tied their shoes. Like, this work has already been going. Like, we're 10 miles in, this guy finally, you know, laced up his shoes. Like, he's about to get on the course, but like, I'm still running my thing. Like, I don't have time for this. Like, yes. Get out of my way. But also at the same time, it's like, oh, hey, this person did it, so now they're a thought leader in this area. No, like, absolutely, like, hell no. Like, this person is not a thought leader in queer theology or in inclusive discussions. This person is at the very bottom, the start line. It's got a lot of, I guess, two people. I keep saying singular. Like, they got a long ways to go, right? And so for people to say, oh, hey, we need to celebrate this. We have, like, basically they're saying, hey, we have somebody to lead the way for us. Like, no, step back. We already have leaders. Like, yeah. we don't need our movement hijacked by the cishet white guy. Like, this thing's been going. This thing has been predominantly ran and pushed forward through really a lot of Black femme, trans people. Like, some of the biggest movers have been people that were Black and trans femme, and that is throughout U.S. history. Like I said this at Content Warning, the reason we know that trans people existed in like the 1800s is because Black trans women were arrested for prostitution. So like our history is always been through the most marginalized within queer communities, and to have somebody who is part of the dominant culture to step up and say, hey, I'm here, I'm able to lead this, like, no, you still have so much to work through, you have so much privilege that you have not even started to discuss. And the fact is, we can see within like their framing that is still using predominantly white theology. Like, there is no liberation in white theology. What they're saying is, we are going to include you. So it's kind of like this. Imagine that it's like King of the Hill, right? Where people try to push off the top person. Cishet white guys have always been at the top. Well, eventually they're like, you know what? Maybe we'll open it up to Black people, not immigrants from like Mexico or something. Like, if you're brown, you're still maybe not quite. And so you kind of half let up Black people, right? Because you can't let them be all the way up. And they're like, oh, well, maybe you can start letting like women up. And then like, you know, maybe we can let queer people up. But at the top, it's still the white cishet man that's on the top of this platform that is saying, hey, I'll let you up. Yes. I'll let you up. That's not how this works. Like, no, it's a power structure that needs to be torn down. You shouldn't be able to say, hey, I am going to let you up. What they should be doing is say, hey, this needs to be redone completely, because we don't need that power structure, that hierarchy that allows cishet men to be the dominant within our culture. And that's really what a lot of this is like, it is an old hierarchical system that's based off of white supremacy, where white supremacy says we will treat you equal. But the thing is they can also get rid of you just as quickly. And that's happened throughout history with basically every marginalized group. Like I come from a denomination that when it started, it took like 20 years for them to ordain the first woman, right? They don't ordain women anymore. privilege, when it is able to be given from the dominant culture, it can be taken away. And that entire structure is broken. But whenever we are stopping to celebrate a white cishet man finally doing something, we're maintaining that structure of the dominant culture saying, hey, we're going to let you up and be equal to us for now. We're not actually addressing the fundamental issue. And that's really kind of the most irritating for me, is like recognizing this, it's an entire system of oppression that goes from the top down. And the further that somebody is from the cishet male, and the, Melissa Wilcox talks about this quite a bit there. I love their work, but the white cishet male is the dominant, and each step that you get away from that dominant, the more other a person is seen. So at the top, you have a cishet white male. At the bottom, you have a black trans femme, homosexual, or, you know, just not straight. and each and every time that you add a different step away from that dominant, the more oppression, the more marginalization that occurs. And it's stuff like this that just says, hey, I'm going to let you come and be kind, be one with me for now. It's still maintaining the white cishet narrative. And that's already been proven to be toxic and harmful.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think there's an aspect of it too. I think all of that is so good. And so spot on. I think there's also like a natural, authentic, genuine response when somebody like me sees somebody who either looks like me or represents a big part of my story doing something that I want to like identify with and celebrate and all that sort of stuff. Like there is some like just like uncontrollable emotion that like when I, you know, if I see somebody who is a hero to me do something like affirm gay people, and I'm like, oh man, I want, like, I'm feeling a feeling about that. That is okay. I think it's okay for people to authentically just like feel a feeling about, you know, somebody that they relate to, identify with, was a big part of their story. I mean, I remember seeing Josh Harris, right? And like, and all the stuff that, when he went through that thing that he went through, I was like, I was a young pastor. I was manipulated into being this like thing. I read the book. I wasn't the particular victim of the brand of purity culture that was weaponized using Josh Harris's theology, right? Because I was a man. But like, there's like a genuine and a natural response. And I think sometimes we're like told like, hey, can you examine that for a second? And like, there's this reaction like, are you saying that my feelings or my, I don't know, it feels very snowflakey, but it's like, I feel like it's the way it is. Are you saying that my like feeling about this is wrong? And it's like, yeah, maybe it is. Like maybe it is something to be examined of like why this is so meaningful to you, to look to this particular person and why their affirmation of the queer community means so much to you when these other people didn't. I'm not saying that you're evil or wrong for feeling that. It's probably, you know, a explainable thing why you feel that way, but maybe take a beat and like examine why that is.
I think that there's an aspect there also, like we're talking about this layer later on. We saw this probably over the weekend, and now we're talking about it later Monday night, right? So our initial reaction is going to be kind of different than probably what we're feeling right now. We got to let people have their initial reactions. They come from different places. There's people that are responding to it positively because they're seeing hope. There's people that see it and ignore it because we are generally don't care what the cishet white dudes are doing. And that was kind of my response. And then Megan, you had your response where there's a sense of injustice that is going on here because so much harm has been done within this sphere to just drop it because somebody finally takes the barest minimum of a step. It is a form of injustice. And that has a visceral reaction. And to police that reaction it's not okay.
Yeah, and I think about the times, I just think about how protected they are from that marginalization. And I think just even on Twitter, I remember I had a viral tweet that just, it was probably one of my most viral tweets, and it was like a nothing thing. It was about inflation. It was about like my gas bill being high and my looking like my Costco bill and my Costco bill looking like my mortgage or something. And after it started getting traction, I promoted Tori Williams Douglas's White Homework and just said, hey, because people were starting to reach out to me to say, hey, like, you've tweeted about the economy. Can I donate money? And I was like, I'm good. But like, there's actually an account here that provides housing for indigenous people and black people in Portland. Like, this is a really great work that she's doing. And the amount of racism that came out of the woodwork from as little as like, I retweeted this tweet and now I'm going to unretweet it because you have promoted something that's what they say racist towards white people, right? And I'm like, oh, you know, it had 100,000 retweets. So now it's 999,999. I'm so sorry. But anyway, I just, when people start interacting, or I think about when my trans friends, like when people do that like innocent quote tweet of like, what were you like 20 years ago and now, and people post pictures from like pre-transition to their transition. And I know that when people do that, they know that they're putting themselves out there for a lot of hate and attack and slurs. And I think that that's what makes me mad is that I have friends that experience this. I have people in my life. I've experienced, you know, marginalization when it comes to my sexuality. Like, I just feel like these guys are writing on it from this really high academic level where they're like, our voice is so important here. And it's like, I feel like you're not on the ground seeing what's really happening to queer people and seeing what's really happening to people that are oppressed, because I see this not just on social media, in real life. Like, I see this, and I feel like they're not seeing it. They're just like kind of using queer people as fodder for, you know, oh, we're going to have that. Like right now it says it's the bestseller in gender and sexuality and religious studies on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, like, are they going to have their goodbye Christopher and Richard Hayes moment on social media? I don't know. Like,
I'm sure.
Yeah. I'm just,
well, yeah, I mean, you bring up such a great point. Like, the worst that is going to happen to them is they lose some money, right? Like,
or Christopher Lifeway Hayes, endorsement.
Yeah, yeah. Christopher Hayes is a professor at Fuller. He could actually lose his job, so I will give him that. Fuller is not affirming. Last February, they released somebody at their school because they affirm same-sex marriage. And so they dismiss them from their position. Fuller's not affirming. And Christopher Hayes is actually putting his job on the line. And that's something. I'll give him that. That is something. Do you know why I don't use my real name on Twitter and stuff? Like, it's literally for my safety. Like, transvangelical exists for my safety. Because like him saying something could have financial implications. Me saying something could have like deadly implications. Like the amount of protection that they have from who they are, from their skin color, their gender, from their orientation, from their academic circles. And let's be honest, most academic circles are inclusive. Like the publisher is Yale University Press. Like it's not necessarily a Christian publisher. Gasp. Like who would have thought? But like
it's not a university.
Yeah, right. But so like the SBL, the something of biblical literature, or yeah, like I think you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
talking faster than I can think. So they still take money from like Baylor University, right, who has a religious exemption that allows them to literally sexually harass their students. It is in their religious exemption that the Department of Education gave them. SBL still takes their money, like, and lets them promote their stuff, right? So like Christopher and Richard Hayes, like they're in a place where they're safe. The worst that's going to happen is Christopher loses his job and he gets a job at like probably Yale, since, you know, Yale is doing this, you know? So like, it's not the same. Me being a trans like theologian, and I get it. I like compare what I do and what I put out there in a lot of circles is considered blasphemy. And I said this earlier today on Twitter, like, if like I do these jokes and stuff because I am trying to highlight the fact that my jokes are just jokes. Evangelicalism and terrible theology has real world implications. So like, if you're upset because I talk about the eclipse today and Jesus finally coming and it being difficult to get it out of your hair, like, that's a joke. Your theology says it's okay to put razor wire at the southern border. That's not a joke. And yet my thing is blasphemy. I can only do this because I have a certain level of anonymity, because people get angry and I don't have that necessarily like place of protection that these guys are coming from. So like, yeah, you're right. They don't have anywhere near the same danger that somebody else has, somebody else that who's already been doing the work. And there's been people have done the work far longer than me. I'm a newbie compared to a lot of people out there doing this type of work. And they've risked a lot to say the things that they've said. Whereas Christopher and Richard Hayes, like, they're not risking anything. Like, it's safe. It's a safe step. It's calculated.
I'll say this, and then I want Cortland to jump in. But the other thing I'll say is, not only do they not have the same risk, but they don't. I feel like they don't have an understanding of the scope of the risk that others are facing. Like, they're not only protected from that themselves, but they're also protected from even seeing it or allowing themselves to see what others are facing.
And that's one of the biggest things after transitioning, is like seeing the level of privilege that I had before transitioning to losing it now. And I get that like people have always lived with less privilege than, you know, white males. But, you know, I lived in a place of privilege. I didn't understand privilege really until it was taken away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't have a ton else to add. I think, you know, we've talked about a lot of things here. I think that there is validity to however people feel in these situations, but that doesn't mean that those feelings should or can go unexamined. And that those hold the entire picture. Like, there's more to see for all of us. And I would say, even for those of us who are a part of this community, people like myself who identify as queer and, you know, obviously am impacted as a queer person, I still also have culpability in harm that I perpetuated and caused, right? You think about people like Alan Chambers, who, yeah, I mean, eventually came around and, you know, is living an affirming gay life, but ran Exodus International for years. I think I have the name right, Alan Chambers, who was the director of Exodus International, right? Like, I mean, it is so many of us who are also impacted by the trauma of homophobia also were culpable in perpetuating it as well. And there's an aspect that we all have responsibility to take accountability for our role in that. And in addition to our role in supremacy culture and colonialism and all the other, you know, ills that have stemmed from the brand of Christianity and evangelicalism that many of us, you know, grew up in.
There's, yeah, I hear all that. And it, yes, absolutely. And I love that you bring that up. There's another thing that, and I know we're close to time, but there's another thing that I just want to mention briefly. And that's because it came up in the comments after my thread. Somebody brought up, I think it was Ms. Charlotte, brought up the pastor, I think a youth pastor that became affirming after 9 years of being close with queer people. And people were like, okay, that's great, but 9 years, seriously, it took that long?
And here's the
thing. I still follow that youth pastor, and he's great. He listens. I feel like he takes cues from queer people. Nobody is saying, go away, cancel you. People are just needing to be able to express, hey, like, 9 years is a long fucking time for you to really decide to love people and value them. Like, and like, when people can accept that feedback, that's when that angst and that tension starts to dissipate a little bit. Because I think that what makes me more angry is when you get ranty and then told, why do you feel this way? Just accept this person as an ally, you know? And I think that guy, like, saw that feedback and it was like, fair. That's fair. Like, I agree. You know, I don't think he said that, but I'm just like, I think that that's the approach and the attitude and the posture that I've seen him have. I don't know. I might have missed something, but I just think that's what is missing, because we need to be able to have those critiques and we need to be able to have this dialogue where we say, okay, fine, you've done the bare minimum, and have the people that are writing these books say, okay, I realize this is the bare minimum, versus like, what? You have no idea what, you know, because I think that's what's missing, is that we're critiquing it and not being listened to and being talked over, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and that really goes back to that whole like internalized prejudice against queer people. Like, why aren't you just excited for this person to have done this? Well, there really is no reason for me to be excited for them. There is some reasons to be happy for the possibility of harm reduction in certain circles. We still want more. And that's okay to say. The policing of emotions, especially from people who have been marginalized, like, that is still part of oppression. Is like, you're not allowed to feel those feelings. And that's wrong. I do want to say, like, real quick, like, whatever people's feelings are to this book coming out, whether it's positive, it's negative, like, we've talked about this in kind of more negative terms, but like, if you're positive about this, that's great. Like, we do not want anybody to like change their mind that about a positive feeling, because yeah, there is in fact movement, and we do want to recognize that. Mostly what we're upset at is people telling us how we should respond. Yes. To this book. And that's really what it is, because it's another layer of control, right? It's another layer of control. Like, well, you can't express love towards somebody of the same gender, or you can't identify as something other than your assigned gender. Like, these are rules that people are trying to put on you. Well, okay. now that we finally like pushed back and said, oh, we don't care what you say about those things. And now you're trying to say, oh, you have to respond this way. No, we're actually really tired of you telling us how we should respond. So all of that is to say is like, we're not up here telling you how to respond. However you're feeling about it is valid. Don't let anyone else like tell you how you should feel about this because it's yours. There are no rules on your emotions, your responses to things. There's positives, there's negatives, whatever you want to focus on, that's great for you. Don't let anyone tell you how to do it.
Yes.
Word. Yeah. Standing O.
Can we take that expression in a few different ways or
sitting O, however you like to do it.
I mean, the eclipse happened. Jesus didn't come again. So somebody needs an O.
There you go. There you go.
This has been lovely. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, these conversations, hopefully people find them affirming and helpful. And we're just trying to be curious and make space for all the different perspectives people have throughout these different experiences.
Absolutely. And Alicia, per usual, plug where people can find you.
Yeah. If you want to follow me on something public, just Twitter, at transvangelical. Not really on anything else, but apparently if you tag me in a comment on Instagram, I'll respond like Megan did today. But I'm really not on Instagram. If you want to follow me more privately, my OnlyFans is also transvangelical, and it's just $5 to subscribe, which is a pretty good deal for what I do. And I post things. I've been posting probably 3 to 4 times a week, and about every other week I'm doing Strip Theology Thursday. So, you know, $5 a month gets you 2 Strip Theology conversations.
There you go.
So,
well worth it.
I want to juxtapose that with, I don't think Christopher Hayes and Richard Hayes like have the capability to provide that kind of content, but I
they really don't.
No, I don't know if we want to invite them to provide that kind of content. I haven't seen them yet, so I don't know, but that may not be their thing.
Yeah, might not be. One more plug, I guess. We're still working on it, so I have no ETA, but me and Wild Violet, who's also been on this podcast, are cooking something up, so please be following us to find out what's going on. And it's really, we're trying to do a project that's really came out of content warning from this last year, whenever we really realized that there is not a lot of discussion around positive sex work creation and consumption. There's still a lot of questions there. And if my tweet from last weekend says anything, we still have men that don't understand that saying I do at the altar is not a yes for sex. So
yeah.
we still have a lot of sex ed to get through. So Wild Violet and I are going to be starting a project to focus on stuff like that.
I can't wait.
Cool. Awesome. Thank you so much for being here. It was as always, really great.
I love being a guest on podcasts.
Yeah, this was great. And I feel like at this point, our listeners know where to find us. Patreon.com/thereafter, Cortland Coffee, Pursuing Life. And with that, that's a wrap. We'll continue our regularly scheduled programming after this week. But we just, not an emergency, but just wanted to have a conversation about something that was happening now. So thanks for letting us interrupt.
Yeah. See y'all next time.
Until next time.